Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. What do you know about fungi or fungi?
Something that I don't know how to pronounce. Fungi, fungi, fungi. How do you say it?
Well, I say fungi, but I think the important thing is that people understand what you're saying. So it doesn't really matter what the pronunciation is, as long as people know what you're talking about.
We'll return to that voice in just a moment. Fungi, that's the pronunciation I'll be trying to use during the show today. Fungi are part of a category of life on Earth, a category that includes mushrooms and molds and yeasts, among other things. But how to define them?
Well, that's actually a difficult question to answer. So fungi are a group of organisms. They're often classified as a kingdom. And they are not plants and they're not animals. Those are probably their most defining features, that they're not other things.
And that's?
I'm Bryn Dentinger. I'm an associate professor of biology at the University of Utah and the curator of mycology at the Natural History Museum of Utah.
Dr. Dentinger says that there are ways we can better recognize fungi for what they are, but that maybe those ways are a little over the heads of people who aren't mycologists. Mycologists, by the way, are simply people who study fungi and their properties.
The few traits we have to unite them are pretty esoteric. I don't think most people in your audience would probably appreciate them. Things like subcellular structures, like they have spindle pole bodies present during nuclear division. So I don't know if that means anything to you, but these are the few things that we have that actually unify this entire group. It's a very diverse group, and that's part of the problem.
Recently, I took a walk with Dr. Dentinger in a couple of canyons of the Wasatch Mountains to talk broadly about the study of fungi in Utah, and basically to improve my biological education.
One thing I can say is they're primarily sedentary, like plants, and so up until relatively recently in the history of science, they've been classified as plants. But we now know that they're their own independent evolutionary trajectory, and they actually share a recent common ancestor with animals, with us,
wow.
Not with plants. So we actually share a few things in common, one of which is the posterior flagellum. So if you can imagine what a human sperm cell looks like, it's got a flagellum on the back that whips it forward.
Yeah.
Well, some of the early diverging fungi, which are aquatic, also have that same feature, and we know that's because they inherited that from a common ancestor.
Amazing.
Aside from, you know, getting a basic education on what fungi are, one of the reasons that I wanted to interview Dr. Dentinger had to do with something that I once overheard him say by chance at the Natural History Museum of Utah. While talking about pine bark beetles, the infestation that is having a devastating impact on American forests, Dentinger described those beetles as being engaged in a kind of agricultural project. Because these beetles lay their eggs in the bark of trees, but also introduce a fungus with those eggs, and that fungus serves as both a food for the larvae and, well, kills the trees. But the beetles are cultivating the fungus, and that basically makes the beetles farmers. That was a pretty astounding fact in and of itself, but then I heard Bryn Dentinger say something that was even more astounding. He said that fungi are also involved in an agricultural project, and that a number of forests of the world are being cultivated by fungi that exist in the soil. And what I thought Dentinger was saying with that was that trees are basically a crop of fungi, the way that corn or wheat is a crop of humans. Now, I don't know about you, but I remember learning that agriculture, with a capital A, was one of the defining characteristics of what it means to be human. At some point, humans, and maybe a few of our ancestors actually, began growing stuff intentionally, and that fed into a feedback loop of greater nutrition, leading to bigger brains and more, I don't know, innovations. Agriculture also rooted us to specific places, whereas before we had largely been a migrant group chasing game. Agriculture was supposedly one of those things that made us different as a species. There are, though, other creatures that grow things. Leafcutter ants in the rainforest, for example, are basically bringing bits of leaves into the ground where they're growing a big fungus. But the idea that whole forests are being cultivated by fungi, that idea, which isn't exactly the accepted science, and we'll come back to that in a second, that idea comes from some recent research you may have heard about, research delving into something that a few mycologists have called the Wood Wide Web, connections of mycorrhizal networks in the forests between trees.
just in the past couple of decades in your field, there's been a lot of talk about the wood wide web or these mycorrhizal networks, which are kind of networks of connectors between trees or between plants, connectors of the forest that are made up of, yeah, of fungi. What are these mycorrhizal networks to start with? Like, what is their purpose? What is their function, I guess?
Yeah, so mycorrhizae, which means fungus root, that's what the roots of the word mean. It refers to a plant's roots that are covered or infiltrated by a fungus. And those fungi are particular fungi, and they're performing a function for the plant, which is to sequester nutrients and water from the soil. And in exchange, the plant gives them sugar that it makes through photosynthesis. So it's a cooperation, it's a handshake, it's a mutualism. And over 90% of all land plants on Earth require these fungi and their roots to survive. And in fact, land was first colonized by plants about 450 million years ago, and it was thanks to the fungus on its roots. And we know that from fossil evidence. So if you look around in the world today, what you're looking at is actually a partnership that has very ancient origins and continues to persist to this day.
Yeah, okay, so it's a transfer of nutrients. It's these networks between organisms in the ground through mycorrhizal networks. I guess I want to get to this thing that I happened to catch you saying. You were describing these networks as not necessarily incidental in every instance, but almost as though they were intentional, that to a certain extent, fungi could be considered cultivators of the forest. Can you talk about that? I'm kind of trying to get my head around the idea of the intention of fungi.
All right, let me see if I can explain myself. So I guess first I should say that I should be careful with my language because it would not be correct to anthropomorphize these organisms. As far as we know, they are not conscious beings. They have no capacity for conscious thought or intention. However, there's this concept of these common mycorrhizal networks where plants can be connected to each other via the mycorrhizae, the hyphae, the filaments of the fungus on their roots, so it'll connect to both trees, and information can then flow between the trees. And there is experimental evidence to support this idea. I would say that at the moment, it's still a bit of a romantic notion. We don't know how important or fundamental that is to ecosystem scale processes. The other thing is that it's sort of hard from an evolutionary perspective to explain the existence of these common mycorrhizal networks, because it's hard to understand how that would be inherited as a trait and could be passed on genetically to offspring. So the question is, are we just being dumb? Have we just not figured it out? Or are we just thinking about it the wrong way? And something that has occurred to me and others, this is not my own novel thought, but is that actually what might be happening is the fungus is really the one in charge here. These plants that they're connected to, that's its sole food source. So in a way, the fungus is a farmer, and it's farming these crops. And in order to maintain your best crop, you might have to shift resources around. Yeah. So that's a fun perspective to take. I don't know if it's any more realistic than the other, but
I wonder. I mean, you said it's not immediately clear how the mycorrhizal networks are doing what they're doing, and I guess you said it in experimentation. They have shown that there's a sort of transfer of energy of materials. What kind of materials are we talking about when you're in a forest and there's a network of fungi connecting one tree to another? What's getting transferred? How does that happen?
It's been observed that chemicals are being transferred from one tree to another via the fungus, so things like carbon. And you can trace that. You can feed a tree radioactive carbon and then see it show up in a neighboring tree and measure its movement across the fungus. So that's how we've been able to experimentally observe these things. You know, exactly what's happening, I think it remains to be seen. And I should also point out, I'm not an expert in this area.
Sure. No, I get it. I guess the other question is, why move chemicals from one tree to another? I mean, is it just because you want to benefit one and not the other? But
well, so that's, yeah, so right. So that's, I think, where it comes down to, how do we explain what's actually happening here? Is it really altruism? Is it really one tree saying, hey, You might need some extra resources, I can tell, or whatever. Here you go. Or I think more likely or more easily explained, it's the fungus saying, oh man, this guy's losing resources and I need it to live. And here I'm anthropomorphizing again.
I know, it's
because it's
sticky.
So convenient to talk about it like that.
Yeah.
And just shifting resources over to maintain their whole agricultural system.
Yeah.
Right?
It's just nuts. It's really fascinating. How well do we understand fungi? I mean, like you said, there's a fair amount to learn. I guess it seems, to me, it seems very mysterious, and I'm wondering how mysterious it is to someone who studies it.
I mean, that's part of the fascination for me, is the mystery that abounds still. It's the least studied of the major groups of organisms on Earth. We've only documented about 5% of them. We don't really know. It's really hard to tell, like, how do you know how many things are out there that you don't know about? That's really hard to do. but we think there's anywhere between, let's say, 4 and 12 million species in the world. And we've only documented 148,000 of them. So we've got a long way to go just in terms of writing it down. Here it is. This is what it is. And then the next step is to understand how they're all related to one another. This is one of the most fundamental tasks of science, and it's been completed pretty much for plants and most of the animals for, you know, probably a century.
Yeah.
And so we're lagging way behind in this respect, and unfortunately that makes it really hard, even harder for us to do it, because the interest in doing that kind of basic work is no longer around outside of mycology. Because it's been done for 100 years in plants, who cares? Right? There's just, they have moved on, if you will, from that basic task.
I mean, there are people who discover plants still, though, right? I mean, that's a thing that still happens. It's just not to the extent that it was being done before. And occasionally you hear about, you know, a new monkey or whatever.
Yeah, very occasionally. Yeah. And it makes the cover of Nature, whereas we describe on average 1,500 species of new fungi a year. And how many of you heard of that? Yeah, probably none of them.
Yeah. I couldn't name a one.
Yeah.
So yeah, right, sort of like old school naturalist science, biology. I mean, that's very appealing to me, to tell you the truth. I have to admit.
Well, it should be appealing. I think this is probably where most people first observe the natural world, is from this perspective. It's sort of taxonomy is sort of inherent in all of us, right? We define our world by comparing and contrasting things and putting labels on them, and that's taxonomy. The problem that we face in mycology is that taxonomy is not a science that is considered to be very cutting edge, and so there's very little funding for it. I would say almost no funding for it. And it's not science that is valued by the broader scientific community. And so that makes it really difficult to pursue a career doing that kind of work. And as it turns out, like many of us in mycology, we kind of do that stuff on the side because, you know, we wouldn't be able to maintain our jobs just doing taxonomy, most of us. And as a result, a lot of the modern taxonomy that's going on is being completed by people in developing nations or non-professional scientists. And that's becoming an increasing resource for describing new fungi.
Wow. All right. Well, that sounds like a place to make an appeal to people. Could someone conceivably find a new species of fungi just here in, you know, in Utah and Salt Lake City?
Definitely. Yes. Yep. You know, I couldn't tell them where to go, but and it's not that easy.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite difficult to know that you've found something new, because to know that it's new, you have to know that it hasn't been described before. And that's actually really difficult, in part because the information from a long time ago just isn't well disseminated. It's, you know, not easily accessed. And also the features that were recorded at the time are typically inadequate for recognizing things today.
That's interesting. So people could have described, you know, whatever kind of fungi, but you can't really use that from a scientific perspective because it doesn't have the traits that you need to actually describe a new species for you in the modern day.
Right, yeah, the traits that may have been used to describe it could apply to a dozen species that we know of today. So you wouldn't be able to know which of those 12 they were. Yeah, so we in mycology, we rely very heavily on DNA We have to sequence part or the entire genome to be able to figure out what they are and what they're doing. And that's a lot of my research is based on DNA sequencing.
Where don't they live? Where do fungi not live on planet Earth?
In volcanoes, in deep sea vents, but they do live around deep sea vents. They live under glaciers. They live well under the surface of the Earth. They pretty much are ubiquitous. They will definitely be here after we are gone.
What other sorts of surprising? Obviously, there's some that you can eat, some that you can't. Can you give us some sort of interesting but surprising facts about fungi?
I am not the best at trivia, but the world's largest organism to have ever lived and is currently living is a fungus. It covers 3.5 square miles in the forests in eastern Oregon. And it's a tree parasite, but it produces mushrooms, or it is a type of fungus that will produce mushrooms at a certain point of its life cycle. They've never been observed in nature, as far as we know, but we actually have taken isolates of this humongous fungus and have it growing in our lab, and we've actually got it to produce mushrooms in our lab. So,
are they edible?
They are edible. It's the common name for this is the honey mushroom, and they're widely eaten in Eastern Europe more than anywhere. There are some varying reports of them causing GI distress in people that consume them.
Wow.
So I wouldn't necessarily recommend anyone go out and start gathering them for the table. But
got it. Finally, I think I can't skip over the edible mushrooms thing, since we did get there with the honey mushrooms for a second. There are people who go out and forage for mushrooms. Obviously, I know it's something that people are discouraged from doing a lot because there's a reputation that it's dangerous. And I'm assuming that that's probably true. And you increase your odds, obviously, by going out and trying to figure out which mushrooms you can eat and which you can't, of accidentally grabbing something that's poisonous. But I'm assuming that you, as somebody who studies mycology, you do this yourself. Is it as dangerous as we think it is?
Well, I would say it's no more dangerous than collecting wild berries. It's just easier for people to recognize a poisonous berry from an edible berry than it is for people to recognize a poisonous mushroom from an edible mushroom. Mm. And that's just because most people are unfamiliar with the features of a mushroom. So, you know, it's probably not super dangerous in terms of like the numbers game, like yeah. The likelihood you're gonna encounter a super deadly mushroom is pretty low, I would say. They are around, you know, you could make a bad mistake. They're around in Utah. But they're pretty unusual, and they're not things that you would typically think of putting in your mouth, frankly. So, you know, I don't want to discourage people from going out and foraging. Of course, they should be following all local and regional rules and laws. That's important. You may need a permit to do it. But
it's still a worthwhile endeavor, I guess.
Well, I do it, yes, but I'm very picky also, I should say. There's sort of a tendency for people who first get into mushrooming to get really excited about the possibility of eating something that you find. And that is fun, it's thrilling, but I would say 9 times out of 10, they're of very limited culinary value.
Got it.
But that's, you know, that's a matter of personal opinion. So I'm quite picky about what I go and forage.
I'm getting it. You're a snob about the particular mushroom that you're going to find. You might have a lot of rejects, is what you're telling me.
Yeah, that is probably true, yes.
I like it.
Again, that's Dr. Bryn Dentinger, who is a professor of biology at the University of Utah and curator of mycology at the Natural History Museum of Utah. He's a scientist first and foremost, but as you just heard, he's also someone who likes to eat the thing that he studies. And so before we parted ways, I asked him about the mushrooms in Utah he likes to forage most.
I used to do a lot more foraging when I was younger and had a lot more freedom, so not much. I mean, I like to hunt and fish. I'll forage for berries, like... I go back to Minnesota every year and visit my family, and there we collect blueberries often. Yeah.
Obviously from the fungi world, other than morels?
Oh, yeah. So my favorite, hands down, is porcini.
Okay.
It's a group of about 30 to 40 species globally. There's one that's most common in Utah and quite reliable, I would say, actually. And that's a Boletus edulis is the scientific name for that one. And that's kind of the core species of porcini. And they're delicious. They get to be really big, which is kind of fun. And when they're fresh, if you eat them raw, they taste a little bit like edamame. They have sort of a sweet, nutty flavor. But then what I like to do with them is dry them, because that really concentrates and transforms their flavor. And then they get really umami rich, and they're really good complements to meats and nice. Good bases in soups and sauces. It just adds this dimension that you just can't get from anything else.
What do you eat them with?
I really like to cover meat in a powder. So I'll grind them up in a spice grinder, and then I'll cover the meat in the porcini powder, and then you can saute that in butter.
Have you ever considered just dropping your gig and becoming a chef?
I mean, I don't think it would work out well, but I have ideas.
And all right, I feel obligated to mention here that people do die from eating poisonous mushrooms, and some people just get really sick, even suffering organ damage from doing it. So my plea to you is don't just wander out in the forest and grab some mushrooms for your dinner table. Make certain you know what you're doing and recognize that you're taking certain risks. And that's it for In the Hive here on KCPW, a listener-supported, entirely independent local public radio resource. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for joining me today for this exploration of the world of fungi. Send your thoughts about the program to comments at kcpw.org. You can also post them on Facebook when we feature the show there. Once again, thanks for listening. Both Sides of the Aisle is coming up next.